It's so good to be with you all again. I am humbled and honored to be invited anywhere, never mind to be invited and handed a microphone and told to stand in the front, and never mind to be invited again. Because at this point, you all know me a little bit more than the last time I was here with you, and you decided to have me back again. So thank you for that. For this series, I was instructed to pick a story that was little known, that was not as familiar, which immediately knocked me off my typical strategy, which is just to follow the lectionary. The lectionary is this resource that selects scriptures in a three-year cycle for Christians to follow, and that is what I typically do, is if I'm teaching or anything like that, I just let that pick it for me, because it takes a lot of the pressure off. But Joy said, something that's not familiar, which means I couldn't do that, because the reason that we have stories that are familiar and unfamiliar is partly due to the lectionary, because this resource, it selects Bible passages in a three-year cycle, but it necessarily omits passages, right? There are whole books of the Bible that never show up in these 3 years. And so it took me a little bit longer to figure out what I wanted to talk about today. And I wish that I could tell you exactly how I stumbled upon this story or how I found it. I wish I could tell you, I opened up the Bible and the hand of God appeared and pointed it out to me. But I've got nothing like that for you. All I have is the story of David and the Holy Bread. David coming up to Ahimelech at Nob and asking for bread. And this conversation back and forth about the men. But David was alone, but there are men meeting him. Have they been kept from women? In the version that I read through in the NRSV, it talks about, David says that the vessels of the men are pure, and that is as far as we will discuss that euphemism that is here in the Bible. Just point it out, and we'll move on for today. But this story, so it's a story of David. At this point, David has been anointed as the next king, but Saul is still the king. At this point, Saul's son, Jonathan, has pledged his love to David and has helped David escape from King Saul, because King Saul is out to kill David at this point, and so David has escaped. And here he is at this holy place looking for sanctuary. He's been a shepherd, a soldier, a court musician, he's been a general, and now he's a fugitive, and he's looking for sanctuary. He's looking for a safe place. And this story, when I read it, it felt familiar to me, I think because it felt so common. The story of a person running from those in power and going to a holy place looking for sanctuary, it's not a story that we only find in the Bible, right? If we would have changed these names here, you could have convinced me this story took place in any number of fantasy books or TV shows or movies or anything like that. It just feels like an old-timey story. We don't have the voice of God. We don't really have a prophet of God. We don't have any episodes that take place of the grand arc of history or anything like that. It's just a fugitive on the run looking for sanctuary and looking for food. And the story is short here, just after the passage that we have read for this morning. David asks for a weapon, which I think the priest, I think Ahimelech, is a little bit suspicious of David. You know, it says that he comes trembling before David. I think he's a little nervous about what's going on. And then David asks for a weapon, which I think is a little bit more suspicious. And it just so happens that the sword David used to kill Goliath is kept at this place. And so Ahimelech says, yes, we have the sword that you used to kill Goliath. Here it is. Which again feels even more like this kind of this fantasy literature, like this precious sword being handed back to the warrior from his time of old. But David here is so far from that episode, right? He's no longer the shepherd boy coming in from the field. He's no longer this kind of up-and-coming person, but he's been in the court of the king. People know who he is. People sing his songs, and now he's a fugitive on the run. The end of the chapter ends with him going to the Philistines. Goliath was a Philistine, and now David is going to the Philistines, and he pretends to be crazy so that they will protect him. He hides among the Philistines from Saul. And so it's just this weird time in the life of David. It's this weird time in the Bible, and I'm glad that you all appreciate the weirdness of it, because I think that's a part of what we have here. And so David is coming to this place, and he asks Ahimelech for bread. And the priest says to David that they have no common bread. The only bread they have is the bread of the presence, or the bread, the holy bread. And this bread isn't meant for just anybody to eat. It's only for the priests to eat. There's this special, it is put before the presence of God, and then when it is taken away from the presence of God, it is only for the priests to eat. And so I think there's this moment where Ahimelech, he makes a decision with David, because he comes trembling to David, because David is alone, and that is suspicious. If David was here on official king's business, one would assume he would have a whole group of people with him, a host of people traveling with him, going with him to do whatever this business was. And I think that's why Ahimelech starts by saying, "Why are you alone?" And David says, "I'm not alone. There are people. They're going to meet me somewhere else. It's all going to be okay." And then Ahimelech then says, "Well, are the people who you're going to meet, are they pure?" And David says, "Yes, of course they're pure. Of course they're pure." But this question that Ahimelech asks is irrelevant to the holy bread, because there's no exception for who gets to eat this holy bread. There's no exception in the law and the rules about if you're pure, you can eat it, but if you're not pure, you can't eat it. It's only for the priests. And so the fact that Ahimelech even asks about the purity of the people with David means that he's already made his decision. I don't think he fully knows what's going on here. I think David is lying to him. I think Ahimelech knows that David is lying to him. But Ahimelech decides, "I'm going to give this bread to David. It's the holy bread. It's meant only for the priests, but he's hungry, and I'm going to give it to him." And again, I think these two people are lying to each other, and I think they both know it, and I love that about this story. I love it because there's this complicated web of deceit and this question of purity in the middle of that, of, are you pure? Yes, I'm pure. Are you okay? Yes, I'm okay. And like, they're all kind of dancing around the truth. And I think Ahimelech is looking a little bit for plausible deniability, just in case somebody follows up asking about David, he can say, "Oh, I thought it was a little suspicious, but he said he was on king's duty. And if he's on king's duty, what else can I do except give the guy some bread?" And so I think they're all dancing around each other, and it's messy. It's a messy, messy story here with a priest of God and God's next appointed king in a holy place with holy bread. But the Bible doesn't really care how messy it is. There was a time in my life when I was really certain about things like this, that lying was wrong, right? At all times, at any time, even trying to hide the truth on purpose, if you didn't offer all of the truth, I was positive that that was a sin, and that God had something very specific to say about that. And I think we even have other stories in the Bible, right? There's a story in the New Testament in the book of Acts where these people come in to talk to the disciples and say, "We sold our land. We have here all of the money from the sale of the land to give to the church." And the disciples say, "Is this all the money?" And they say, "Yes, it's all the money." And God strikes them dead in the church for lying. But here we have David and this priest dancing around the truth with the holy bread in the holy place. And this holy bread, like I said, it has a specific purpose in the law. It sits in the presence of God. It is then eaten by the priest, no one else. And again, I there was a time in my life when I was certain of the purpose of holy things, of holy bread, of holy places, of holy practices. That which was holy was made to be followed, made to be respected. It was made to bring glory to God. Holiness was about bringing glory to God. And to even ask questions of this, to even thinking about doing something else with that which was holy, was to disrespect God. I understood that the point of that which is holy was to bring the eyes of the mortals, the eyes of us, up to God. That was what was meant for church. That was what was meant for our spiritual practices. When we think of holy bread today, I often think of communion. I was taught and thought about communion as this solemn moment of quietness, of reflection, of these tiny itty-bitty little wafers that would get caught, you know, right there in your throat, and just enough grape juice to wash it down. And it was all these reflections and all of these ways to bring your eyes to God. And this bread here, though, Ahimelech makes this decision that the point of this bread on this day with David standing before him, David who is hungry, he makes a decision that this bread is not meant to just sit in the presence of God, but this bread is meant to fill the belly of somebody who is hungry. That this holy bread is not meant just to draw the eyes up of the mortal up to the divine, but it is instead meant to fill the belly of someone who is hungry. I believe that holiness was meant to draw the eyes of the mortal to the divine. There's a poet named Donald Hall, and he was married to a poet named Jane Kenyon. They're both American poets in the 1900s. Donald Hall lived to 2018. Jane Kenyon died in 1996. And I think this marriage is fascinating to me because it's two poets who live together in a marriage. And I am not a poet, and my spouse is not a poet, but I can't imagine a household where you have to talk about the things that you have to talk about with your roommate or your partner or your spouse, and both of you are as eloquent as poets, right? The conversations that went on in this house where they had just within a hand's reach the vocabulary and the lyricism of poets, I dream about what that house must have sounded like on a daily basis, and the mundane meeting the beauty of language. But like I said, Donald Hall, he died in 2018, but his wife Jane Kenyon, she died in 1996, so he lived 22 years without her. But when she died, and in his grief, he said this. There's this quote that he has from that time. And this is what he says. He said, "We did not spend our days gazing into each other's eyes. We did that gazing when we made love or when one of us was in trouble. But most of the time, our gazes met and entwined as we looked at a third thing." Their gazes, they met and they entwined as they looked at a third thing. And I really just love that word entwined. I like the way it sounds. I like the imagery that it draws up of their vision, their views of the world joining together and wrapping around each other tightly and winding together and entwining as they look at a third thing. Their love, it caused them to look into each other's eyes rarely, right? In these times of intensity, they would gaze into each other's eyes, but most of the time they stood together and their views, their gazes entwined as they looked elsewhere. And I think that that is holiness. Holiness isn't bringing the eyes of the mortal up to the divine, but holiness is entwining our view with God's view. Holiness is the act of bringing us closer to God, not so that we can stand close to God and get a better view of what God's eyes look like, but that so we can stand close to God and have an easier time looking out and seeing what God sees. Holy acts and holy places and holy objects, it's not about being close to God so that God can hear our singing more clearly, but it's so that by standing close to God, when we look out together, our views are the same and our gazes can entwine together and see and look and work together, having the same vantage. And I think this is what Ahimelech, the priest, was doing here in this passage, in this weird, strange passage here in 1 Samuel. He saw the holy bread not as a protected sustenance, not as something to be held away from people as a tool of God, but rather he saw it as a way to fill the belly of someone who is hungry, because he saw that as the view of God. And one of the other cool things about this passage, if reading this or thinking about this passage, if you have any kind of glimmer of recognition, Jesus quotes this passage in Mark. There's a story in Mark where Jesus and his disciples are walking through a field on the Sabbath, and the disciples pick grain to eat. And when they're called out for it, Jesus says, "Don't you remember David at Nob when he ate the holy bread?" And then he says, "The Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath." The Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Or put a little more inclusively, the Sabbath is made for people, not people for the Sabbath. Or put a little bit more broadly, the holy things are made for people, not people for the holy things. Because if people were made for holy things, then that bread should have stayed right where it was, because it was the most important thing, and David's belly would have remained empty. But because holy things are made for people, the bread was sitting there, and somebody came to the priest and said, "I am hungry," and the priest said, "I have bread." And he asked some weird questions in the meantime, but they got to the point where he handed over the bread. Because again, I don't think those questions had anything to do. I think by the time Ahimelech started asking questions, he was handing the bread over. I think he was just looking for that plausible deniability for whatever was about to come afterwards, because it was a suspicious and messy situation. But there was a hungry person standing there in front of him, and he said, "I have bread. Eat it. That's what bread is for. Even if it is the bread of God, it is for eating. The holy things are made for people. Fill your belly." And I think there are times when we think of our faith, when we think of our journey, when we think of holiness, the end goal to be staring into the eyes of God as closely and as intensely as we can. And I think every once in a while, while we're doing that, when we're getting closer and closer to God, looking into God's eyes, we begin to notice that God's not looking back at us, but is looking off somewhere else. Has this ever happened to you? You're in a conversation with someone and you're looking to their eyes and you start to notice they're not looking at you. Right? So you're sitting eye to eye and you begin to kind of look over your shoulder, trying to figure out what's happening behind you that they're looking at. And I think this is what happens with us and God sometimes, is that we sit here in our worship and in our holiness and we look and stare deeply into the eyes of God, and we begin to notice God's gaze has shifted elsewhere. I can remember as a kid, there was this question of why did God create humanity, right? It's one of these central questions. And I can remember there was this one time when I was in middle school, and we were talking about history, and we were talking about creation. I went to a fundamentalist Christian school, and so we often talked about all of these things all together, right? And one of the things that we were talking about was God created people, and people have done all of these terrible things, and what history looks like. And a classmate of mine, a friend of mine, said, "Why did God even make people? What a dumb thing to do." And I remember being so scandalized. I could not believe she had just called God dumb. Looking back, I think this was the first time I'd ever heard somebody critique God. And I just remember saying to her, "You can't say that. You can't say that about God. And also, how can you say that making humanity was dumb? Because here we are." And it just shattered so much of my head at that moment. Because the answer to that question that I had learned, why did God create humanity, was for relationship. That God created humanity for a relationship. And I don't remember if it was ever said explicitly or if it's just this understanding that I built up on my own. But I had this understanding that this relationship that we were made for with God was one of bringing glory and praise and worship to God, because God deserved it. And I think, and I thought that the end of this relationship was this soul staring, that eternity was going to be spent with us looking deeper and deeper into the eyes of God. And what we were to do here on earth was to spend as much time as possible staring deeper and deeper into the eyes of God. Because I had such a strict understanding of what is holy and what is not holy. Here in this story, we have this holy bread, and we have the back and forth of holy and common, and the priest has holy bread, but he has no common bread, and they're in the holy place, but are the men pure, or are they impure, and all of this back and forth between holy and common. And that was my understanding, that there is that which is holy, and that there is that which is worldly, and the more time we spend on the worldly things, the worse we are doing, and the more time we spend on the holy things, the better we are doing. And there is this strict line right down the middle, and if we can't see where that line is, then we need to try harder, was how I understood it. And I remember the first time there was this song by a band I really loved, Mumford & Sons. I drove this little white truck in high school that had a CD player, and I would roll down my windows and I would play Mumford & Sons as loud as I could driving around the little town that I lived in. And I would hear these lyrics in that song about, are you prepared to meet your maker and your creator? And these ideas of like, I think this is Christian. I think this is about God. And I went and asked my sister, who's older than me and I thought to be much more wiser than me. And I said, are they a Christian band? And she said, no. And I said, are you sure they're not? I think they're talking about God. And I can remember her saying to me, the older I get, the more I realize that there's not really Christian and not Christian all the time. Sometimes it's just people talking, and they talk about God and they sing about God, even if it's not a worship song. And again, it just shattered my mind that somebody could sing a song that talked about God and it not be a Christian band, because there was holy and there was common, and the two should never meet. But in that framework, I thought about, the more I stare deeper into the eyes of God, the better off I am. And the more I look away from God, the more I'm not living up to my potential. And I'm ignoring that which is holy for what is common. And I know at this point, talking about Mumford and Sons and staring into the eyes of God and Jane Kenyon and Donald Hall, that we are a step and a half away from David and Nob and the bread. But I think that this is what happens when we think about holiness, the end of holiness not being soul staring with God, but entwining our gazes with God's gaze and looking out. Because when I think about God creating us for relationship, I don't think about the end of that being us staring deeper and deeper into the eyes of God. But I think about the third things that our gaze can entwine with God's gaze and look out to do. If we are partners with God, if we are in relationship with God, and our gaze is meant to entwine with God's gaze, and we're supposed to look out, then we become partners with God and God's work. And God's work is the continuing creation of the world that we live in. We get to partner with the Creator to create. And I think there are times in this work when we do stare into the eyes of God, because there's nothing else to do sometimes, right? Even Donald Hall, when he's talking about his wife, he says that in these moments, they did stare into each other's eyes. And I think there are times when all we can do is stare into the eyes of God. It's in times of celebration. It's in times of desperation. And all we can do is look at God. But we look at God not because that's where we're going to end, but because we're renewing our strength to continue our partnership in the creative work of God. And I think that's what we're doing here on a Sunday morning. When we gather on a Sunday morning, whether we or wherever we gather as a community and we worship together, I think we're directing our gaze to God. When we sing our songs, when we take part in communion together, I think we're looking deep into the eyes of God. And it's here on holy ground and in holy place where we lock eyes with God. And God sees us and we see God. But we don't stay here. We go out. We look away from God so that our gaze may entwine with God's gaze. And we can look out to the work of creation together. Because the act of love is not staring deep into the eyes of the one you love, but it's entwining your gaze together and looking out to the third thing, into the partnership, into the work that you're doing together. David stood with Ahimelech and Nob, and there was not a lot of truth surrounding them, right? They wove this web of deceit together. They were testing each other. They were both trying to find safety. None of them had malicious intent. They just wanted to be safe. David was hungry. Ahimelech was afraid. And the priest Ahimelech, he made a decision. He looked at the bread of God and he recognized that the purpose of this bread was not to just sit in the presence of God, but the purpose of holy things is to entwine our gaze together with God. The purpose of this holy bread was not just to sit there, but to fill the belly of a person who was hungry. And so here we are today. We're together. We're staring deeply into the eyes of God, the one who created us. And that is good. And that is love. But it's not the end. The end is when we go out from this place together and we continue to partner in the holy work of creation. Because our gaze is entwined with the view of the divine. Amen.